I'm Barbara Troutner, and today we are going to learn about prostatitis, epididymitis, and orchitis. These are no longer relevant. So what are we going to cover in our online lecture only in the next 30 minutes? We'll talk about some things that aren't covered very often, but could pop up in board questions. These are going to be epididymitis, prostatitis, the side effects of infectious complications of prostate biopsy, and then orchitis. And I put a drawing of the relevant anatomy here, simplified, just to explain that all of these things are connected in some way to the urinary tract. And so urine and bacteria in them can end up retrograde in any of these structures and lead to infections. So this will be a case-based learning today. Our first case is a 72-year-old man who presented to the emergency room with fever and urinary retention. Unfortunately, no culture was sent, but he was sent home with a transurethral catheter and started on ciprofloxacin. He came into the infectious diseases clinic a month later. This is actually one of my patients. And the urinary catheter was still in place, and he had no follow-up with anyone else. At that point, his temp was 102.5. He had actual costovertebral angle tenderness on exam, and he was admitted and started on ciprofloxacin. I'll tell you, this is a historic case, so we had fewer concerns about the empiric coverage with ciprofloxacin. Unfortunately, we guessed right. His blood cultures ended up growing serratia, which was sensitive to cipro, and his urine cultures grew serratia and Klebsiella, which are both sensitive to cipro. On hospital day two, of course, we took out the catheter had been removed, and he was urinating fine, but he's still febrile to 102.3. He reported right testicular pain and swelling. He says now that he thinks about it, he probably had that for the last 7 days, but it's a little more obvious now. So given the 2 days of fever on ciprofloxacin and the new awareness of right testicular pain and swelling, your next step is to add vancomycin to cover enterococci, order a scrotal ultrasound, add doxycycline in case he had a sexually transmitted infection, or consult urology emergently for testicular torsion. Now, I put a picture on the slide of picket fence to remind you that with most of the deep tissue urologic infections, people do get a picket fence fever, which means they spike temperatures for 2 or 3 days, even after you've started them on treatment. The question is, are the picket spikes going down or not? So, going into the answer, your best choice right now is to order a scrotal ultrasound, which you would have already done, to see what's going on with the swollen right testicle. Why is the answer not add vancomycin? Because you already know the causative organisms. You've got both the urine and the blood growing serratia, and it's covered by cipro. You've got doxy to add for sexually transmitted infections? No. He's had an indwelling catheter in for more than a month at this point. It's unlikely that he acquired a new sexually transmitted infection with the indwelling catheter in place. And also his persistent fever at 48 hours is normal for pylo, epididymitis, prostatitis. It just takes a while for that fever to go down. And you don't need to consult urology emergency for testicular torsion. That has a different physical exam with a high riding testicle that's oriented differently. And also, if he'd had torsion for 48 hours, you're too late. You've missed the emergency. So just a reminder of the normal structure of the testicle and the orientation in the scrotal sac, the fact that the epididymis is on top of it. In cases of epididymitis on physical exam, you actually can often feel that swollen and tense epididymis, which is what we felt with him and what showed up on the ultrasound. So they show up with testicular pain, swelling, and tenderness, often some redness of the scrotum, fever. They can present with dysuria and other urinary irritative symptoms because these all start with a urinary tract infection. There could be urethral discharge. They often have reactive hydrocele, just, you know, swelling and edema in the area. And the testicle can also become involved if not treated early. And it's a gradual onset. So not sudden like testicular torsion, and the cremasteric reflex is preserved in epididymitis versus torsion. A tip when you're examining the scrotum and you're looking for epididymitis, some people are obese and it's really hard to see the posterior scrotum when they're lying flat in bed. And of course, the epididymis is around to the back of the testicles. So if you have the patient lie on their side and pull their knees up, you can see the back of the scrotum very clearly. And I think that's a helpful physical exam maneuver. So what are the risk factors for getting epididymis? Well, our poor patient had so many of them. He had urinary outlet tract obstruction from his UTI a month ago, and then he had urinary tract instrumentation with the indwelling urinary catheter. Other things that can cause this are prostate biopsy. Also, inserted anal intercourse is a risk factor for epididymitis with gram-negative organisms. Patients with immunosuppression often have, there's some of the ones with the atypical organisms, some of the fungi and mycobacteria. And of course, sexually transmitted infections are also a regular cause of epididymitis. It's really any condition that facilitates retrograde flow of urinary bacteria can lead to epididymitis. And you can see in this diagram how the epididymis is on the back of the testes. All right, so what causes epididymitis? Well, the CDC and a lot of things break it down by age and say that sexual transmission is more likely under age 35. I don't know. I've certainly seen sexually transmitted infections in our 80-year-old veterans, so I don't know that I believe in the age breakdown. But I think this table is just helpful to help you think about what the agents would be. So if it's sexually transmitted, you need to think about gonorrhea, chlamydia, mycoplasma. If you're thinking it was more from a prostate biopsy or urinary tract instrumentation or insertive anal intercourse, then you're thinking about the enteric organisms, E. coli, Klebsiella, Proteus, Pseudomonas, and some enterococci. But if it's been more of a chronic picture, then you've got your atypical organisms, TB, Brucella, Nocardia, Blasto. The list is very extensive in this area. So how do you work it up? On physical exam, you expect an intact cremasteric reflex. This means you stroke the inner thigh and the testicle on that side should elevate. You would not find that with torsion. The testes should be in the normal location and there's no draining sinus as a clue. And again, flip the patient over and look at the back to make sure there's no draining sinus on the backside. Obviously, you're ruling out urgent things like Fournier's gangrene at the same time. You can do a gram stain of urethral secretions if there are urethral secretions. This is just illustrative gram stain of urethral discharge that showed Neisseria gonorrhea. You can see the intracellular gram-negative duplos. Urinalysis and urine culture, and then you want to test for, if you're thinking about sexually transmitted diseases, do nucleic acid amplification testing. If they look pretty sick, have a fever, consider blood cultures. If they don't improve within 48 to 72 hours, remember it takes a while for the temperature to come down, but scrotal ultrasound, which you're probably going to get anyway if it's swollen, and get urology involved early if there's concern for torsion. I think we've hammered home this point, but I think it is important to know the difference between torsion and epididymitis. There are many differences, one of which is the speed of onset of pain. You also need to be thinking about orchitis when you're thinking about this, and we'll get to that later. But you can often feel the thickened epididymis on physical exam, and you can certainly see it with ultrasound. All right, so how do you treat it? You know, all the algorithms look kind of confusing to me. They want you to decide if the patient is high or low risk for sexually transmitted infection. I think that's actually very hard to decide. But I think the way I look at it more is, do they have a reason to have it as a non-sexually transmitted infection? Now, our patient that had an indwelling catheter in for a month, which, as he actually pointed out to me, his ID doctor prevented him from having sex, he was lower risk for sexually transmitted infections. Other patients that you would consider lower risk would be if they had a recent urologic procedure, if they were having difficulty voiding with irritative voiding symptoms. So then you're going to treat with Bactrim or Levofloxacin empirically for covering enteric organisms. The treatment algorithms also leave out the fact that they could have resistance to these agents. I think they're using those because of the known penetration of the prostate. But anyway, that's what's recommended on the CDC website for epididymitis. If they're at risk for sexually transmitted infection, again, hard to decide. Most people seem to be at risk. If they are not having insertive anal intercourse, they haven't had a recent urologic procedure, they don't have any urinary obstruction, then you treat for sexually transmitted infection, just STI. You treat with ceftriaxone and Oxy. However, if they do have one of those other risk factors and you think they could have a sexually transmitted infection and you're treating empirically, you would use ceftriaxone for gonorrhea and you could use fluoroquinolone, which can cover the chlamydia, to also cover your gram negatives. For everyone, you want to remember the scrotum is normally in a dependent position, so if you can elevate it, that'll help. And ice packs also help because they do get a lot of edema in the area, and that leads to the hydrocele. So elevation and ice packs. So what do you, happens if you don't manage it appropriately? Well, also antibiotics, anti-inflammatories, we talked about that. But you can progress to some bad things, testicular infarction, scrotal abscess, or epididymorchitis. Moving on to case number two. We have a 63-year-old man who is currently unhoused in Houston who's had an enlarging right testicle over the past 4 months. He's not febrile. He has thickened right scrotal skin but no visible fistula. His white count is high. He has negative HIV, negative beta HCG, negative RPR, negative AFP. CT with contrast shows some uneven enhancement of the right testicle and epididymis. The left epididymis was also enlarged with diffuse enhancement. So it's not just one side. So there's a test here you would not do next. TB spot, urine culture for AFP, testicular biopsy, or urine PCR for TB. So the test you would not do would be a testicular biopsy because that is actually contraindicated in germ cell tumor. Unlikely that he has a germ cell tumor given his age, but importantly, if you have TB or a fungal infection of the testicle, the biopsy can be insensitive. You could get a spot that just doesn't happen to have the organisms in it, or you may not see the organisms. So the testicular biopsy is actually not the way to go in this case. And given that he is living homeless, it's been going on for 4 months, it seems to involve both epididymi, you're thinking about TB as a chronic infection in this case. And so you probably are going to do the urine PCR for TB. So, but all the other TB tests are reasonable too. Genitourinary TB, you should think about. We see it, you know, with some frequency. It starts in the epididymis typically, but it can be hematogenous or contiguous spread, even direct from sexual contact. There's a lot of ways TB can get there. Prevents a slowly enlarging painful scrotal mass, and people often confuse it with cancer. And then you didn't, TB testing can be positive. You want to do AFP stain culture, PCR of the urine, and don't do the fine needle biopsy. And you definitely want to treat it to avoid fistulas, abscesses, and infertility. Moving on to prostatitis, another confusing topic, which is inadequately studied. So the NIH has consensus categories for prostatitis. I will tell you, I think these came from a meeting in 1991, and we're still working with these same consensus categories. But the areas we're going to talk about today are acute bacterial prostatitis and chronic bacterial prostatitis, or really acute and chronic infectious prostatitis. We are not going to touch on the chronic prostatitis, chronic pelvic pain syndrome that is not infectious. And we are not going to touch on asymptomatic inflammatory prostatitis because that's an incidental finding, no need to treat. Understanding these categories, and again, we're focusing on the first two, acute bacterial and chronic bacterial prostatitis. In both, you can have bacteria, at least intermittently for the chronic bacterial prostatitis. It's localized to the prostate. You definitely will have an abnormal rectal exam in acute bacterial prostatitis. In fact, as we'll discuss, a gentle digital rectal exam is probably your best way to make this diagnosis. And in acute bacterial prostatitis, patients are sick. It is a systemic illness. This illness is probably frequently confused with kidney infection because people will look sick, have fever, shaking chills. The chronic prostatitis, the rectal exam is not necessarily abnormal. I mean, in the literature, it says there's a boggy prostate, but when I've talked to urologists, they're not so sure. There is always a boggy prostate, but you would not expect your patient to be systemically ill. So moving on to case number three, we have a 69-year-old man who presents with pain in his lower abdomen, rectum, and perineum for the past 48 hours. He has chills and nausea in addition to urinary urgency, frequency, and dysuria. He is not feeling well today. You do a gentle, with emphasis on gentle, digital rectal examination and find a painful and swollen prostate. He has been unable to void also for the last 10 hours. So your patient's in trouble. What should you do? Should you give him some nitrofurantoin? Should you consult urology to catheterize him? Should you culture express prostatic secretions? Or should you check a PSA level? You don't want to give nitrofurantoin. It doesn't penetrate tissue. He's potentially bacteremic. It's not going to help you with that, so not the right choice. You do want him to urinate. Trapped urine that's infected is an abscess, and so you need to drain the abscess. However, in this case, you do think his prostate is involved and inflamed, and so you probably need urology to make sure the catheter is passed appropriately and with care. But you definitely need to get the urine draining. Culture Express prosthetic secretions, no, no, no. That is for chronic bacterial prostatitis trying to make the diagnosis. You don't want to massage an acutely inflamed prostate because we know that will cause bacteremia. Gentle rectal exam is the way to go to make the diagnosis, but you don't want to do the firm 1 minute prosthetic massage where you go, you know, over each lobe of the prostate and stroke towards the center. PSA is not going to help you right now. It's going to be high. The prostate is involved, but it's not going to tell you anything, and the rate of fall is not necessarily helpful. So not recommended. So how does acute bacterial prostatitis present? Acutely ill patient. Prostatic tenderness is the distinguishing feature to tell you the difference between pylo or just bacteremia of urinary source. You expect them to have fever, chills, and irritated urinary symptoms with lower abdominal or perineal pain and trouble voiding. And the pathogenesis is either from starting in the bladder or often after a prostate biopsy. They can also have hematogenous spread to the prostate. And urinary catheters, urinary instrumentation, urinary retention, those are all risk factors for acute bacterial prostatitis. So we do actually, you know, see this one in our male veterans. So what can cause it? It's like everything can cause it, just kind of like epididymitis. But the acute, most of it is going to be caused by your Enterobacterales or your leading causes. Pseudomonas can be there. We see some staph. We see some enterococci. Worldwide, those are actually caused of Aegis as well, and probably hematogenous spread in the staph. HIV in particular is associated with Salmonella of the prostate. And then if, you know, the board questions, if they've traveled to Southeast Asia or North Australia, think about Burkholderia. And if it's sexually transmitted infection, a particular contiguous spread from the epididymis, you think about gonorrhea or chlamydia. If you're thinking about chronic prostatitis or in an immunocompromised patient, those are the groups that are a little more likely to see the mycobacteria, to see all the fungi, to see Brucella. So how do you work it up? Physical exam is key. You're expecting a painful prostate. Painful prostate is different from the general discomfort of a rectal exam. No one really thinks a rectal exam is comfortable, but you're looking for tenderness over the prostate itself. I think we have to do more of those exams to make this diagnosis more accurately. Your analysis and urine culture, consider blood cultures. It takes about 48 to 72 hours for the fever to come down all the way. So you're probably going to be doing some imaging. CAT scans in particular are done in anyone now in the ER that's got a fever and abdominal symptoms. So on the CAT scan, you may pick up if there's a prostate abscess, which is important. Those greater than 2 centimeters in size almost always have to be drained. Those less than 1 centimeter don't have to be drained. And there's a kind of a zone in the middle where you'd be talking to urology. And then, of course, if they can't void, call urology and see if they'll place the catheter. How do you treat it? Again, the microbiologic causes are really diverse. And so these are just general recommendations. I don't think there's going to be a board question on choice of antibiotics, but you want to start broad for your sick patient. And how long do you treat acute bacterial prostatitis? Again, there won't be a board question on that, but at least 2 weeks, somewhere between 2 to 4 weeks. And you can step down to the oral antibiotics later. There's a lot of things that penetrate the prostate. Although if you can use fluoroquinolones or Bactrim, those have by far the strongest evidence base for treating prostatitis. How long to treat chronic prostatitis? You won't have a board question on this one because there are studies that report 4, 6, and 12 weeks. And please note that like one of the key references that we're using for all of our treatment of prostatitis is this Lipsky article from 2010. So it's time for more studies of prostatitis. Case number 4. We have a 72-year-old man who presents with pain in the perineum, tip of the penis, and scrotum. It's been going on for 3 months. He had lower back pain a week ago, but that pain has since subsided. He's had 2 episodes of urinary tract infection marked by burning on urination in the last 6 months. On physical exam, he has a prostate that is both boggy and slightly tender. So what is the most common cause of the chronic form of this condition? Because we're talking about chronic prostatitis here. So is it herpes, chlamydia, E. coli, or candida? Right. E. coli is the most likely the cause of his chronic prostatitis here, given the history of recurrent urinary tract infection. You can find anything in the prostate, just like we've been discussing. But with recurrent UTIs, it's usually the same organism that's been in the urine. So how do you diagnose it and find the organism? Well, first of all, the patient's not acutely ill. It's more of a chronic scenario. How can you differentiate chronic prostatitis from just recurrent UTI that's coming from the stool. The best way is probably the two-glass test. No one really does the four-glass Mears-Stamey test anymore. It's too complicated. The two-glass test is you have your patient void part of their urine into a cup. It's a clean catch, right? They void a tiny bit into the toilet. They void some into the cup, but then they stop urinating. Then you do prostatic massage, which is through the rectal exam, and it's massaging both lobes of the prostate, which is both sides of it, towards the center over the course of 1 minute. Then you have the patient void again. And if you get tenfold higher bacterial counts post-massage, then you can call that chronic prostatitis. If not, it gets kind of iffy because people can have just recurrent UTI, but recurrent UTI shouldn't have the chronic pelvic pain associated with it as well. So case number 58. We haven't been speaking through case 58 yet. A 58-year-old man presents with fever and shaking chills the day after undergoing transrectal prostate biopsy for possible prostate cancer. Prior to the biopsy, he had received one dose of oral ciprofloxacin. 3 months ago, he was treated with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole for UTI. In the emergency department, his temp is 101.5 and he has Rigor's. He reports rectal pain and difficulty voiding. His creatinine is normal. Blood and urine cultures are sent. Which of the following antibiotics would be your best empiric choice here? Talking about just treating him for a day or two until you have culture results. Amikacin, fosfomycin, ciprofloxacin, or trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. So your key factors here is he's sick and he had Bactrim in the past 3 months and he had Cipro prior to the biopsy. So I'm not going to be able to trust either of those agents. The prior Bactrim use could mean he now has resistance and then this situation developed right after he got Cipro. So he probably has prostate biopsy associated prostatitis with a Cipro resistant organism. And I'm not able to rely on trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole given that he had that one pretty recently as well. So amikacin or an aminoglycoside, a dose today, maybe a dose tomorrow while you're waiting for cultures is a very reasonable choice with normal renal function. You could also use carbapenems or third generation cephalosporins. Fosfomycin is not gonna get adequate levels in the bloodstream and with the biopsy associated prostatitis, they are often bacteremic. Cipro, the organism is presumably resistant. So antibiotic prophylaxis for prostate biopsy is strongly recommended. Pre-procedural antibiotics reduce the risk. This is, of course, we're talking about transrectal prostate biopsy with these. They're starting to do transperineal, and that's much lower risk of infection. So probably new guidelines will come out for that. But right now for prostate biopsy, most are transrectal. And so there's no one best choice, but we're using fluoroquinolones, Bactrim, Gent, and ceftriaxone. You're not gonna get a board review question on the choice. But the dose, you might get it. One dose, 1 hour to the procedure, prior to the procedure. And no benefit for enemas prior to the transrectal biopsy. An infection after a transrectal prostate biopsy is almost always caused by fluoroquinolone-resistant E. coli because fluoroquinolones are what's usually used. So when they get the infection, it's usually a resistant organism. Case number 6. 55-year-old man with HIV with a CD4 of 32 was referred to urology because he's got BPH-type symptoms. Prostate exam showed asymmetric enlargement. Urinalysis and urine culture were pretty unremarkable. Ultrasound showed bilateral nodules consistent with malignancy, but the biopsy revealed, and you can see the biopsy pictures. We have a silver stain here. We have some organisms here in the tissue. So is this Candida, E. coli, Cryptococcus, Aspergillus, or Nocardia? And Cryptococcus, because you have granulomas with round organisms that have capsules, and they're clearly yeast on silver stain. So I put this in just to remind you that just about anything can get into the prostate, and it's a site of concern for opportunistic infections in anyone with immunocompromise. All right, this is our last case, wrapping up with a bang. So we have a 35-year-old man. He is a member of a religious group that does not support vaccination. And he went to a wedding in Nebraska, and it was like 250 people at this wedding. 2 days later, he had pain in his left ear and jaw tenderness. It's very uncomfortable. But what really got his attention is 11 days later, he had noticeable swelling under both sides of his jaw, fever, and painful swelling of his left testicle. And the most likely causative agent is mumps, measles, E. coli, or Neisseria gonorrhea. What exactly was going on at that wedding? I'll let you think about that for a minute. Probably pretty straightforward. And yes, this is mumps, which is associated with parotid swelling and orchitis. They can come together, or more likely, they get the parotid swelling first, and then they get the testicular swelling later. And mumps is a manifestation of orchitis. Orchitis is isolated involvement of the testes. And if you see isolated involvement of the testicle in adults, it's usually a viral infection. And it most likely is mumps, Coxsackie B is possible, and lymphocytic chorioamnionitis. Bacterial just involving the testicles is not particularly common because usually the epididymis is involved first and then it goes to the testicles. So it's the same organisms as epididymitis. But I think that the image on this slide, in my opinion, is the most effective vaccine campaign image I've ever seen. It says the swelling's not so bad. It's a severe testicular pain. And it talks about protect yourself against the mumps, get immunized. So a gold star to the Alberta vaccine campaign. Because we're seeing more mumps in the United States, which I'm sure is not news to anyone, mumps has been rising since 2006. Not seeing necessarily the big outbreaks like what we're seeing with measles, but we see outbreaks in communities with close contact. That means college students. It means groups of people that come together for a festival or a wedding. It means people living in barracks or dorms together. So that's where we see the outbreaks. And part of it is the vaccine is not as effective for mumps as it is for measles. So two doses of the mumps vaccine, the appropriate vaccine, is 88% effective. So it's hard news to take, but we do see mumps in vaccinated people that were vaccinated appropriately. And you don't want to do IgG or IgM testing to verify that it's mumps because those aren't going to be real helpful, particularly in vaccinated people. So you want to do PCR testing. So to wrap things up here, we talked about epididymitis, where you consider sexually transmitted infection versus E. coli and other enteric flora. We talked about prostatitis. I want you to start thinking, in men with febrile UTI, could this be bacterial prostatitis? And you're going to have to detect that by a physical exam of the prostate. You want to consider chronic bacterial prostatitis in men with recurrent or relapsing UTI and pelvic pain. Keep in mind that all sorts of indolent organisms can invade the male genitourinary tract and set up infection, and that isolated orchitis is rare in adults, so consider a viral etiology. And I hope everything is clear now, but if not, I'm sure you will email me your questions. Thank you so much.